Thank you very much. This is a replacement for a replacement talk, but it still makes me an invited speaker, so thank you very much. I'm actually here to make sure that Zoe's not getting into trouble, my student, and also to take all of Doug's money.
You weren't here soon enough.
And I'm going to take all of Doug's money and possibly his car. We'll work on that. Anyway, I'm going to talk about gravitational reaccumulation in the solar system. Those of you who are at the Ensenada meeting will notice quite a bit of similarity with this talk. The reason being, I've been inundated by a 24 graduate student course, which is taking all of my time. So it's been an interesting semester, let's put it that way. I have a bunch of collaborators with whom I work, and I rely on them exclusively to do a lot of my work for me. I've highlighted my students, in particular Zoe and Kevin Walsh back at Maryland. Now, hopefully this is going to be something different that people haven't talked about. I want to talk about rocks, basically, and what we know about rocks, or what we don't know about rocks, and why they're important in our understanding of planet formation. And what's come to light, I mean, people have known this to some degree for a long time, but what perhaps wasn't appreciated very much was that reaccumulation, the fact that although gravity is weak for small bodies in the 100 meter to several kilometer size range, it's nonetheless quite important. And it could play quite an important role in determining the evolution of the small bodies, a role in planet formation, and in understanding asteroid families today and binary asteroids. Okay, now I'm going to talk mostly about gravitational aggregates. And these are, it's a highfalutin term for rubble piles you've probably seen in the literature before. Gravitational aggregate is just means that you have something that is being held together mostly by gravity. There could be some material strength. And we think that many of today's planetesimals, the comets and asteroids out there, could fall in that category as being gravitational aggregate. I want to start with a somewhat busy graph just to put some context on all this. This is a plot as a function of the radius of a target body. The amount of energy required per unit mass to permanently remove 50% of that body. So this is the catastrophic disruption energy threshold. And all of these lines are basically theoretical calculations. The only experiments we have of shooting things into rocks and seeing how much we need to break them up is somewhere over here, the left-hand side of this diagram. These scales are going up into planetoid sizes, and we unfortunately can't do experiments on those at that level. What's interesting about these graphs, and you can see more or less in the trend here, is that when you're a small body, your ability to resist disruption is determined mostly by your internal strength. You know, we're all familiar with that. You have a rock in your hand. It's not falling apart in Earth's gravity field, clearly. So it's a strong, competent body. As these things get larger, however, and Doug should pay particular attention to this point, the bigger you are, the more likely you are to have a serious flaw. And eventually what happens is gravity becomes more important than your internal strength. You don't have the internal strength to hold yourself together anymore. Instead, you've got gravity. And so on the upper, that's right, you're just falling apart, that's right. As we get into larger and larger sizes, the gravity becomes the dominant thing holding these bodies together. And there's this interesting transition region, which is, you know, as you can see, there are many ideas about what the transition region should be, but it's a rough order of magnitude, about 100 meters. So bodies that are about 100 meters in size, we believe, are on the threshold between being strength-dominated and being gravity-dominated. What that means is if you go out today and you look at bodies in the solar system, you find something that's maybe 50 meters in size, your first guess would be, well, that must be a competent piece of rock. Otherwise, by now, it would have suffered some kind of collision with something else and been completely destroyed, and you wouldn't see such a body anymore. Whereas if you're larger than that, several hundred meters in size, and you smack it, the likelihood is that it may be completely disrupted, or it at least has a chance to hold on to itself because of its gravity. So bodies that are smaller than a few hundred meters, you might think of being monoliths, which is an overused term, but I won't get into that. And anything larger than a couple hundred meters could be reaccumulated bodies. They could be perfectly competent as well, but they might also have been reaccumulated. Okay, anything else? Okay, good enough. For those of you who don't think about asteroid families particularly, just a quick review. In the asteroid belt today, between Mars and Jupiter, we see families of asteroids. And a family is a series of bodies that share orbital characteristics and typically spectral characteristics. So the idea is that each family probably originated as a single body in the past sometime when it was disrupted. And you can see these trends by just plotting, for example, the sign of the inclination of the orbits of the particles as a function of the semi-major axis. Some of these features are due to resonances with Jupiter, mean motion resonances and so on, but other little groupings are actually asteroid families. Why these are important is that there actually is a laboratory for studying large-scale collisions in the solar system, and those are the asteroid families. If they really were created by large-scale impacts, then we at least have the relics of what happened. So the question is, can we now take a numerical simulation and reproduce the families that we see today? Now, people have tried this, of course, and part of the trouble that they've encountered in the past is that they can either get the size distribution correct, and you get the size distribution by looking at the relative reflected light from each of these bodies, and so you can figure out what's the biggest, what's the second biggest, and you make a power law, size distribution. Or they can get the velocities right, which is basically the distribution in eccentricity and inclination for these bodies. The trouble was trying to get them both at the same time. Can you explain the energetics that seem to be the remnant of this collision, as well as the size distribution? And with my collaborators, Patrick Michel and Willie Benz, we've come to the point where we think we understand now how to get both. And the solution comes in two slides. Let me just review what I just said. The idea is that the previous idea that people had about asteroid families was that the pieces you see are in fact solid competent bodies. You had some large asteroid, you smacked it, it fragmented, and those pieces went off to form the families you see today. However, if you look at the actual relative E's and I's of these family members, they're quite high. There are some processing things that can do this, resonance with Jupiter, Yarkovsky effect, and so on. But when you take those into account, it still requires fairly high energy to disperse the fragments in the way we see them today. But if you do laboratory experiments and also numerical simulations at higher, larger sizes, the energy required to give the supposed monolithic fragments their currently observed E's and I's would be so great that you'd expect the target should have been pulverized. Those fragments shouldn't exist anymore. They should have been destroyed. So how do we fix the problem? And the problem can be fixed by gravity. Don't ask about the mouse. I have no idea. Basically, we have to remember these bodies are now, we're talking about things probably in the gravity regime, several hundred kilometers in size. They get smacked and they can be completely pulverized. In our simulations, that's typically what happens. They go down to the smallest pieces that we can model, sub-kilometer size. They get dispersed, but then little instabilities, gravitational instabilities occur and cause reaccumulation. This is very analogous to what we think happened to Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 when it was broken up in a close pass by Jupiter. You tear this thing into a long string, and then it starts to bead up as the gravitational instabilities take over. And I'll show you some examples of that in a different context later on. So what we have here is a model of the Coronis family. Coronis is fairly famous. It has one, Ida, for example, is a member of the Coronis family. And it's thought to be quite old, several billion years old. And just by adding up all the mass and doing some elementary calculations, you can come to the conclusion that this was a very catastrophic event in history several billion years ago. The largest piece remaining after the collision was probably only 4% of the original mass. So we can tune our calculations so that we can reproduce that initial big fragment, the 4%. And then we let the simulation go and see what happens. And the way we're doing these simulations, I should explain, is that we have an SBH rigid body model with fracturing, I should say, for the target, and then we smack it, and we watch the shockwave propagate through, it takes a few seconds, and then we end up with the velocity field of ejecta. That gets transferred over to a code that I helped write, which does large-scale gravity. So we're talking probably 100,000 particles or so in this simulation. And just to see where do these fragments end up given that initial condition after the impact.
Derek,
yes?
You made a statement in the previous slide about the system being monolithic.
Yeah.
Does that mean the size has only a small range? And how, when you say monolithic, exactly what do you mean?
Right. I was being very imprecise about what I meant by monolithic. So what I would really mean by monolithic is something that has a very high relative tensile strength, so that if you were to fly that object by the Earth, it would stay together. So the shuttle, space shuttle, is a monolith, for example. Whereas I imagine there's a continuum of asteroid strengths that go from basically completely pulverized, which has essentially no relative tensile strength, all the way up to monolithic. And there's evidence that I'll show you in a little while which suggests that, in fact, things smaller than 100 meters tend to be monoliths in the sense that they have a relatively high tensile strength, but it may not be that high.
You mean that's one solid?
Well, let me step back even further and say no, just something that isn't a rubble pile, something that has some tensile strength. And the reason we know this is because of the spin rate. So these little guys, we observe through looking at the reflective light and the amplitude of the variation, and we see that some of these little guys, less than 100 meters or so, can spin about 1 hour. Some of them spin 10 minutes. Okay, and there's no way they can do that if they're rubble. Okay. However, there's only one body that we know of out of about 500 that spins faster than that limit and is larger than 100 meters or so. All right, you're all waiting in anticipation of me clicking the button so you see the movie. let me just explain what's happening here. This is the basically the end result of the SPH. We've blown this thing to smithereens, literally. And we're now going to turn on gravity and see where the pieces end up. And here's what happens. Okay. Doug's machine is a little choppy there, but that's all right. So what was that?
Did you zoom in?
There might have been a zoom out. Yeah, I'd have to go back and check it. But basically, let me run it again. You can see that things accumulate, and they have a little, this guy here, for example, has an entire system of bodies around it. There's going to be a little dance here between three bodies.
Is there a coefficient of restitution that you use?
In this case,
yeah,
right. In this simulation, it's the coefficient of restitution is zero in the sense that when two particles collide, they're assumed to stick for the purposes of this model. And that's actually not a bad assumption because as these particles come back together, the relative speed is very small. It's the outgoing speed, which is fast. And so you have these little density enhancements that are going radially away from the impact point, and they start to reaccumulate and then fall together.
Why does that solve the monolith problem? Doesn't that require some knowledge of how they come back together, glue together as one body,
Right, okay. Well, if you were to repeat this calculation without using the sticking and just having a coefficient of restitution, as long as the coefficient of restitution is less than one, so there's at least some dissipation, you will get this end result. The only difference being that you wouldn't end up with a perfect spherical body necessarily because it's going to have some angular momentum. It'll have a shape to it. So we've lost the shape by our approximation. But when we redo this calculation with actual competent bodies that are not allowed to stick, they will nonetheless recollect in these forms.
What was the initial energy and kinetic
microwave? Okay, this was a 5 kilometer per second impact of a 30 kilometer body into something that's about 200 kilometers in size.
If it was a rubble pile, could you send everybody off to infinity?
No, that's the cool thing. In fact, for this simulation, we assumed that the impacting bodies were monoliths, and we actually used SPH to model the shockwave propagation, and it basically fragmented the body down to our resolution limit. If you redo this calculation assuming a pre-shattered body, you actually get a slightly different result, which is a better match for observed asteroid families, and I'll get to that in a bit. So that's kind of cool. Yes?
Fragment is one SPH particle indicator, and then later on to do the recoagulation,
that's right. So we have to make this transition from the SPH to the solid body code, which, you know, it's a little dodgy in the sense that these SPH particles represent mean field variables, and it's not a true correspondence. But nonetheless, you have some packet of mass going off at some velocity, and so we do the replacement there, assuming some bulk density for the stuff, which is about 2 grams per cubic centimeter.
How much mass is in this thing compared to how much you started
with? 4%. Yeah, we tuned this so that it would actually give us the correct Coronis largest mass. Actually, the distribution of other bodies has basically moved out of the view, but there is a distribution of particle sizes. Yes.
This thing was done. The thing
This was done not in a heliocentric frame, but we have done this calculation in a heliocentric frame, and it makes very little difference to the outcome.
When things come back in and stick, you're saying that perfect accretion, zero coefficient of restitution leads to this spherical body. But what happens? Do you allow them to roll, or otherwise, why is it?
I wasn't clear on what I meant. Is basically in this simplification, you have two spherical pieces that come together. And then we just go bleep, and turn them into a new sphere. Okay, so they lose their identity. Okay, but if you repeat this process with spheres that don't lose their identity, you would get essentially the same result, but you would have more information that we've thrown away here. Particularly, you'd have the shape of the body, which is going to be important for understanding the characteristics of orbiting debris. The spin is conserved. So the angular momentum of the system is conserved. So although they collapse the spheres, they are rotating. Yeah. Can't see that in the movie, though. Lots of cool questions. Oh, here I go and explain what I did. I've already explained it, so maybe I'll step through it. But basically, we take an SPH code, we connect it to an n-body code, and we simulate target shattering and fragmentation and reaccumulation. Now, we don't expect to get a perfect match with observations, the reason being that there are lots of processes going on. These coronas, for example, we think are several billion years old, so it has been collisionally eroded. The family members themselves have impacted each other, and there have been interlopers that have interfered. This would tend to make the size distribution a little shallower. And there are other perturbations due to gravity, typically from Jupiter. And Bill Bakke's favorite thing, the Yarkovsky effect, which, by the way, those of you who are unaware of this, has been demonstrated now with radar images of near-Earth asteroids. They've been able to show to many sigma that, in fact, the orbit of an asteroid has been perturbed by re-radiating photons, basically. So you can actually move a multi-kilometer-sized body by letting off heat, essentially. It's very cool. All right. Here we have a few examples. This is that calculation I showed you earlier was from a much earlier paper. This stuff appeared in Nature, I think last year. And here is the observed size distribution of Coronis, and we were able to get a reasonable match using a pre-shattered target, and not such a great match using a monolithic target. The implication being that there's something about the momentum transfer in the collision that if you're already shattered, the outcome is going to be changed somewhat. And so you end up with a greater fraction of large size bodies. You don't have just one big guy and lots of little guys. You end up with a fairly continuous distribution of moderate size guys, which is a better match with observations. There's still a lot of physics there that we don't quite understand. Basically, we're just smashing these things together with different scenarios and getting a good match. So now we have to go back and figure out why that is.
Well, you mentioned at one point that 4.4% has been tuned to get that. Right?
Yes.
You could have a single collision.
In this case, yeah. Previously, there were papers that the problem with Coronis was that there was these intermediate sized bodies you can see here. And some people thought, well, maybe that means that there was one collision and then there was another collision later on to fill in that population. And what we can do here is say that, no, there only needs to have been one massive collision which did the whole thing because if we start with something that was already fragmented. And we've also done this calculation for the Karen family, which David Nizvorny and his colleagues at Sriri discovered. Which the cool thing about Karen is that it's only 5 million years old. They were able to trace back the orbits of these particles, and they converge at a point 5 million years ago, which means they haven't been disturbed by gravity and Yarkovsky, and we can get a good match there, assuming again that we have a pre-shattered body. But that's consistent because Karen family is inside the Coronis family, so it should have been pre-shattered according to these calculations. Confusing, this is basically how we match the energy, but I'm just going to skip that. You can ask me about it later. Okay, do you want to talk about binary asteroids?
Sure.
Okay, good. Wasn't sure what I was going to do if you said no.
Two is better than one.
Two is better than one. Just on this whole theme of reaccumulation, I'm sure many of you are aware now that there are a lot of binary asteroids out there, asteroids with their own moons. And before 1993, this was just a theoretical exercise that maybe these things would exist. In 1993, the Galileo space probe found Dactyl orbiting Ida, which, as I said before, is a Coronis family member. Since then, there have been over 32 of these guys found. And there are various techniques for finding them. You can point a telescope at it and actually see these things. So this is Bill Merline, also at Sriri. Sriri just does too much stuff. You're into everything. This is a beautiful double asteroid, 90 Antiope. So they actually saw this with the telescope. And basically, there's not much room for argument here. This is most likely a binary. There might be a small mass bridge, but I suspect follow-up measurements now have shown this to not be the case. A lot of the asteroids were discovered by light curves. This is a little harder to do because there are some ambiguities that could mask themselves as a binary. But it's just like for eclipsing stars. You look at the amplitude, and if there's a dip that repeats, then you're pretty likely that there's something going in front, and you have a companion. And radar, super cool image. This is a near-Earth asteroid, KW4, and they pointed basically an enormous police radar gun at it, called Arecibo. And they look at the... well, yes, clearly you can see this is way too fast. If you get a radar image of your car and it blurs, that you're going to be in for a really big ticket. So just a word of warning on these. Yeah, if you can catch this, right. A word of warning on these images is that you're not really seeing the real thing here. This is actually delay Doppler versus, or frequency versus delay. Okay, so it's in a funny coordinate system. You have to do a massive inversion to actually get the shapes. But it does tell you something about what's going on. We know that there's a body that is fairly large and something is going around it. That can be unambiguously interpreted from this image. Very cool. So a lot of the, we're getting great orbital characteristics, of course, with this sort of data from radar. You can really pin down the orbit and see, learn all sorts of stuff about the asteroids. Okay, well, these are cool, and we're seeing lots of them, and there's going to be, I'm sure, hundreds to be found in the next little while. The question is, how did they get there? Why do these things exist? We wouldn't necessarily expect a binary to survive all that long, because at some point it's going to get hit, one of them is going to get hit by something else and be disrupted. So it could be that these things are fairly recent, at least the ones in the near-Earth asteroid population. Near-Earth asteroids only have a mean lifetime of about 10 million years anyway. And if the near-Earth asteroids have binaries, something's presumably occurred to create these fairly recently. But we also find them in the asteroid belt. We find them there's one in the Trojan population, and we also find them in the Kuiper belt. And at current date, we have different theories for each one, because no one theory seems to explain them all, which is a little disconcerting, but it's probably true because the time scales are so much different by the time you get out to the Kuiper belt. So you need different theories. The one I'm going to concentrate on is looking at near-Earth asteroid binaries. What would happen if you had a body that had been reaccumulated due to a previous massive collision in the asteroid belt? Or maybe they're born this way. We don't really know, you know, whether these things start off as rubble piles. Take one of those and send it by the Earth. What happens? Well, what happens is you can make binaries, among other things. So this guy got a little too close to the Earth, was pulled apart, but not so much that it completely dispersed. Again, we had this instability take place where things kind of glooped back together. And in this case, we end up with a quite, that guy, don't worry. Yeah. We end up with a quite stable system. I followed this out for, I don't know, something like 400 days, and it doesn't change very much. As you can see, there's lots of dynamics to, oh, there's another one. Lots of dynamics to investigate here. This is basically a proof of concept. My other student, Kevin Walsh, has done literally tens of thousands of these models, shooting them in at different angles, different speeds, to see what fraction of the time they get binaries, and how do the shapes of these asteroids change. And we're going to be able to compare these results to the observational record and tune our simulations and get some understanding about the internal structure of asteroids.
How close do they have to get to the Earth?
To do anything interesting, if it's a rubble pile, in the sense that it has virtually no tensile strength at all, you have to get in within 5 Earth radii. Okay. That doesn't happen very often, but Bill Bakke has run a bunch of simulations starting with sort of clones of current known near-Earth asteroids, and we get hundreds of such close encounters over the lifetimes of these bodies.
So,
I don't know, actually. And certainly you get close encounters much more often than you do hits, but I'm sure there must be a few hits in there. I didn't ask him that question. It's an obvious question. Actually, here I was just cheating to make it look pretty. These are spheres, and I used yes, it's artistic. I used a ray tracing program to blob these things out, and it makes a beautiful looking asteroid. Isn't that great? But in fact, there's several hundred spheres make up these guys. Don't be too deceived. Sorry about that. It's very naughty.
But the dynamics of the pinky spheres.
Yes. Yes. How are we doing for time?
But the spheres are many spheres, right?
Actually, this will be a better example when I show these movies. This is exactly what that thing was, except here I'm smashing two together instead of, say, 10 to 15 minutes. Okay. What implications does this have? I mean, if these bodies are broken up to begin with, or they're broken up at some stage during their lifetime, perhaps they started this way. We don't really understand. I presume you guys have been talking about this previous week. How do we go from dust-sized grains to the pebbles to the small boulders to the larger objects? Is this some weird agglomeration that results in perfectly competent bodies? Or is it the accumulation of smaller pieces in a fluffy mixture that remains fairly weak until it gets so large that it can squish itself under its own gravity? Okay. Maybe you guys have some answers for that. But if we assume that perhaps in the early solar system these bodies were fairly weak, this gets us to a nice way of dealing with the fact that planet formation simulations really ought to have a good model for what happens when two planetesimals collide. For example, we might be able to explain the fairly low eccentricities of terrestrial planets by dissipation in a disk of fragments left over from these collisions. So if we start with the assumption that we have rubble to begin with, we can actually perform experiments smashing them together. And there's really only a few free parameters here to play with, because the important thing is that gravity sets the answer primarily. Okay, and that means that we can throw out a lot of uncertainties we have about the nature of the material and other aspects. We can just concentrate on what happens when these things collide. And so that's what Zoe's been working on. Well, she's finished doing this. But you can smash these guys together. They either go splat, or they go wee. We've seen asteroids that look like this, by the way. Cleopatra is something like that. The dog bone asteroid. And things like this, where you can end up with here's a little satellite. It's another way to make satellites, of course, is through collisions. We think that's probably the dominant mechanism in the asteroid belt. NEAs don't collide that often. So what Zoe's been working on is taking these models either as a database or as a rule that when two planetesimals collide in a planet formation code, say, well, we don't really sure what the answer is, so let's replace them instantaneously with rubble piles, do a little quick calculation, see what happens, and then keep track of the debris that is created as a result of these collisions, and perhaps this will lead to lower eccentricity protoplanets. So here's a very, very simple example, just a proof of concept, with just a few planetesimals in a very rapidly sheared disk. And sometimes when they collide, they turn into rubble piles briefly, and then are refrozen into solid bodies. Sometimes they dissipate entirely and they never come back. So we have some minimum threshold, and if the reaccumulated products are too small, then they just become dust, so-called. So now this is like 10 bodies. We've done this with a million, okay, which is a little more interesting. That's work in progress. Okay. That's a little more directly relevant to planet formation. Blah, blah, blah. Very quickly, if you doubt about gravitational aggregates and whether they exist, there's a fair amount of evidence now. Of course, we have Shoemaker-Levy 9, and we have relics on the surfaces of moons, including our own moon, which suggests that something like this hit something like that and resulted in a line of craters. We have crazy underdense asteroids like Matilda, 60 kilometers in size, it's only 1.3 grams per cubic centimeter, and yet it has no evidence of water ice. It has these enormous craters here, which, if you think about it, if you're a solid body and you get hit, you have a tendency to shatter. Whereas if you're already pulverized, you have a tendency to absorb the impact. The analogy that I use is, say you take a gun, which is something I don't adhere to because I'm a Canadian, but anyway, take a gun, and you shoot a vase, a glass vase, and it's going kablooey, right? Now you shoot a sandbag, okay, and that sandbag will be able to absorb the impact and make a little crater, but it's not going to destroy the whole sandbag. That's sort of a rough analogy. So there's evidence that Matilda is rubble pile. And here's the thing I was talking to Doug about. This is actually kind of data now of spin rate of near-Earth asteroids versus light curve amplitude. That is a proxy for their shape. So something that's really elongated is up here. Something that isn't is down here. And you can see that there's a threshold to the left of which, in other words, slower rotating bodies are accumulating up to some fastest speed here, which is about a 2.5-hour rotation. Anything that's a solid dot is thought to be larger than 100 meters. Anything that's an open dot is thought to be smaller than 100 meters. So the small guys spin faster. There's a couple guys that might be spinning faster and are larger than 100 meters. But basically, most of these guys cannot spin faster than 2.5 hours, which suggests they're made of rubble. If they were trying to go faster than that, they would fly apart. Blah, blah. There's Amalthea, a moon of Jupiter, the inner moon of Jupiter, where there shouldn't be any ice. Okay, it's 1 gram per cubic centimeter. This is most likely a reaccumulated body. In fact, the press release said, oh, it's a rubble pile, which is the wrong term to use, but anyway. Yes, worried about rubble piles. I don't want to take much more time. There's a very complicated graph, which is really cool, because it does this. But if someone wants to ask me about Jacobi ellipsoids, we can come back to that graph. Okay, I just want to give you a quick overview there that basically gravitational reaccumulation probably plays an important role in the early formation of planets, possibly. It certainly plays a role in the asteroid families we see today, and it may also explain the origin of binaries and so on. And it suggests that simulation methods that extrapolate solely from laboratory experiments may get yourself into trouble there. So you may want to consider thinking about the role gravity would play in these collisions. And I'm just going to stop there. Thank you.
You didn't really address the very first issue you made, namely, why are these things monolith? Namely, that during these re-mergings, you know, recollection, reassemblage, you know, why do they have this tensile strings? How do they actually glue together to have this irregular shape? I mean, after all, in that asteroid that you just showed us, there are some rims of the crater. There are some tensile strings that is left, right? But how is it that in this sort of a recollection process, how did you simulate any aspect of that? Do they glue together, you know, with small contact points or what?
Well, all right. So I'll just say that the thesis of this is that gravity is what's holding them together. So I'm not too concerned about what other bonds might be formed as a result. But your comment about Matilda, in fact, you don't see much in the way of rims. In fact, what's interesting is that you have two craters that are sitting right next to each other, okay, and yet one has not disturbed the other. And that's very strange. If you had a solid body that you were smacking into and you had a previously formed crater there, it should have been damaged by the first impact. Now, and I invite you to take a sandbox and make a crater.
I'm not questioning that the material strength is weak.
Right.
Okay. Now, what I'm questioning you is that in your simulation, you're replacing the merger product with spheres. Okay, you haven't really addressed why the material strength relative to gravity has certain ratio, because clearly it's not just gravity alone. If it's gravity alone, I'd get back to a sphere. But none of are spheres.
I see. No. Okay. All right. Thank you for bringing up the next graph. That's actually what this was. That's what this suggests.
I know there's an ambush.
Right.
I'm not going to let you get away with it.
Yeah, we'll talk it out tomorrow night. Basically, it's a very good point, because if you think of these bodies as being fluids, say, so you have a body that's controlled just by gravity, and you might think, well, it's a fluid body, then the equilibrium configuration of such a body is a sphere, clearly. Okay. But we're not thinking of these as being fluids necessarily. We're thinking of these as being granular constructs, which have properties in common with fluids, but are not precisely fluids. And to investigate some of this, because people are now using my code to do these sorts of simulations, I did the following experiment with a student, an undergraduate. We basically, this is a plot of axis ratio, so minor to major and intermediate to major, as a function of normalized spin period, normalized by the bulk density of the body. Now, there are formal solutions for a viscous, self-gravitating, otherwise perfect fluid on these diagrams. You can look them up in Binney and Tremain. And they're basically the Maclaurin and the Jacobi sequences. And they're shown by these solid, curvy lines. What this means, basically, is that, for example, here, if you're a body on this portion, there's two solutions. You're here, and you're up here at the top line there. Basically, you're an oblate spheroid. So your Q2 is equal to 1, and your Q3 is somewhere on this line. And that's true for a fluid that's spinning at a particular rate. Now, the question is, does the rubble pile behave the same way necessarily, and do granular materials behave the same way? So what we did was we dropped a whole bunch of rubble piles where these X's are shown. We started them in these configurations. So some of them were spinning very, very fast and were very elongated. And some were basically perfectly spherical and not rotating at all. And we asked the question, well, what happens to them? Where do they end up in this phase space? And where they end up is shown by the colored boxes. So anything that's green has not lost any mass, and that's where it ended up on the diagram. Anything that's yellow has lost about 10%, anywhere up to 10%. Anything that's red has lost more than 10%. And what you can see is that you can maintain a highly elongated shape with a granular material. Basically, you can fill the space up to the Jacobi sequence here. So in other words, you can take a rubble pile, which is very long, like this, and just leave it in free space and not let it spin, and it will maintain that shape. And the reason for that is that there's, in order for it to go to the spherical, the final sphere, you have to add energy. Basically, these bodies are made up of finite-sized chunks, and so you need to give them a little bit of energy so that they can get over these tiny potential wells, which is the interlocking between these pieces, so that they can form a sphere. So if you take a big hammer to that elongated body, it would go and come back to form a sphere. And in fact, that's what we found. So the ones that actually lost mass, that were going so fast they couldn't handle it, they end up on the Jacobi sequence. You can see that the yellow squares here, the red, you know, reasonably good match on the Jacobi sequence, the same on here. So in other words, a reaccumulating body will tend to form a fluid shape. Okay, so when they reaccumulate, they'll tend to be either triaxial like a Jacobi or biaxial like a Maclaurin.
Is it rotation that's doing the elongation?
It's the rotation doing the elongation.
There is instability there. There's a bifurcation point right around this, you know, these points. Okay, it's well known that they will split into two.
Yeah, that's what this is.
And they will move away from that synchronization into a stable synchronization, which separates them quite far apart. There are two synchronization states, and Pluto Charon happened to be in the fairly wide synchronization state.
Okay.
But it needs dissipation.
Right. Yeah. Well, okay. Well, definitely would there be dissipation in these models as well. So the thing is that it's the granularity that can preserve the shape is what I'm trying to say in this diagram.
I think the key here is compressive strength.
Right.
Al Harris pointed out to me years ago that Phobos is inside the Roche limit, yet it's perfectly stable. Because it has strength in compression, and therefore, even though it may be a rubble pile, probably is a rubble pile, it can't deform into the shape that would make it unstable as a fluid.
Yeah, that's right. In our SPH models, in fact, we assume an extra bit of strength, which is basically a proxy for the compressional strength. Yeah, so it can get you a little bit further past the Roche limit. Yeah, that's right.
Derek, could you put up your slide showing the Q-star relationships?
Yes, all the way back to the beginning.
If I understand what the rotational data is saying, is that asteroids tend to be built of pieces that are about 100 meters in size, right? Because you get the fast rotators when you have things smaller than 100 meters.
Right.
But yet your transition, and most of the Q-star plots that I see between gravity and physical strength, happens at a much larger size than 100 meters. Can you explain that?
Well, in fact, there's been as you can see, there's been a number of thoughts about this. I think that, Eric Asfog and Molly Benz are, I think, one of the more recent papers on this. In fact, this is their curve here, the solid with the dots. And they come out at about 100. And I think Dan Derda was possibly, this is in centimeters down here. So 10 to the 4 is 10 to the 2 meters, so 100 meters in radius. Okay. I think there's still a lot of uncertain physics in here, which is why it explains this large scatter. Some of these are analytic calculations, by the way, whereas others are simulations. And so this is still a point of contention that people are trying to improve their models and do a better job. But most people would say, yeah, it's between 100 meters and a kilometer.
Now, Derek, I wish you'd been here yesterday to hear the discussion on planetesimal formation. We have a crying need for understanding of the circumstances under which aggregate bodies can coagulate when they are subject not to gravity but to surface forces. Certainly your code could be adapted to model, say, the collision of a couple of meter-sized objects or a centimeter-sized aggregate into a meter-sized aggregate as a function of velocity just by putting in the appropriate surface forces between the particles, and you can turn off gravity.
Right.
And I'd very much like to see you do that. Maybe we could convince some of the hardcore skeptics that you don't need gravitational instability.
Right. Andrew's grinning in the back.
The asteroid we know most about, Eris, appears to be monolithic.
Ah, well, okay.
And
the time has come.
I wondered if in among the binaries we have measures of their mass and sizes. What are the densities of those binaries?
Right. So the binaries, just to answer your second question first, the binaries that we're getting are anywhere from 1 gram per cubic centimeter to about 2.5. Okay, so there are some in the not so porous regime and some that are in the silly porous regime. And what I'm going to show you now is this plot that was in my chapter in Asteroids 3. And this is this idea that there's a parameter space of possible asteroid configurations or any body that you want to talk about. Here we're basically plotting relative tensile strength, the ability to resist being pulled apart, and porosity on the other axis. And so an idealized rubble pile, like the simulations I've been performing for you, would be up in this regime. So essentially zero tensile strength and about 50% porosity because they're made of equal size spheres. And what we would argue is that Eros may not be consistent with a rubble pile in the sense that we know the porosity is low, it's 20%, something like that. So it would appear somewhere around here. But we don't really know what the relative tensile strength of Eros is. There are some features on the surface which look like they're coherent through the entire body, which suggests some coherent strength. But it could be that it's internally fractured, for example. We can't rule that out. There's no reason to suspect that it has to be a monolith, for example. It could be somewhere in this regime, up here, say, something that's been kind of shooken up a bit but hasn't really changed shape and hasn't introduced a lot of void space in the interior. And then that would still sort of qualify as a gravitational aggregate. What we really need to do, of course, and this is something Eric Asbaugh has been proposing, is go to an asteroid, stick a bunch of seismometers on it and smack it with something and just see what is the internal layout. And of course, it'd be nice to send an astronaut to dig a hole too, but we have to rely on President Bush for that initiative.
And make an impact.
Oh, I thought I'd get through the whole talk without Doug sticking one of those in, but no.
Any other questions? That's it? Okay, let's thank Derek again.